You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Once upon a time, the home run was considered to be one of the most thrilling plays in baseball. Now, our guest coming up says it may actually be killing the sport. We'll look at the problems it's causing for the game, why it's happening, and what, if anything, can be done about it. First, tens of thousands of people have been protesting in Puerto Rico, calling on the territory's governor to resign. Governor Ricardo Rossello says he's staying in office, but in a Facebook Live video yesterday, he said he won't run for re-election after his current term ends. The announcement hasn't changed much for protesters who are in their second week of rallies, and some now in the Puerto Rican legislature are starting to talk about impeachment. Carlos Suarez Carrasquillo is a lecturer in political science and an affiliate faculty member of the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of Florida. Carlos, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob. Thanks for having me again.
Can you talk about why these protests got started?
The protests the thrust of the protests were a number of conversations that were the product of the governor and his most intimate circle, comprised of members of his cabinet or people who were former members of his government, who engaged in a number of conversations regarding statements of political rivals, homophobic, misogynistic, defamatory comments and against individuals, in particular the Puerto Rican press, etc. So that those leaks or the publication of that chat on Telegram spurred this. But it's important to keep in mind that before this, the governor's administration was under significant duress because the former head of the Department of Education and the former point person who led the process of leading the healthcare provision on the island were accused recently by the FBI of corruption. So that came first, and then the revelation of the chats on Telegram.
Can you tell us about the scale of the protests we've seen so far?
The scale can be argued is unparalleled, for the following reasons. Not only the significant number of people who have taken it to the streets, but also the fact that you have significant mobilization, but also people who maybe in the past were unwilling to engage politically. And I say this because interviews by people on the island have literally said so. Either I never engaged politically, or I voted for this governor, yet I want him out. So I would point to the scale, the people who comprise the protest, and to that you could also add the fact that they have not been led by the main traditional political players, meaning political parties, unions, etc. It has been quite organic, and to be fair, the artistic class, people who are performers, actors, etc., whether they live in Puerto Rico or outside of Puerto Rico, call to action. And also, I should note this, that has been quite visible. It has also featured segments of the Puerto Rican working class that call themselves as such, and many of them have mobilized by making use of motorcycles, and that also has been documented by media. So you have a number of not traditional players, the mass number of them, and what they're advocating for, that I would argue make this such an unique experience. And also that we have seen these protests for the past week to 10 days. Also, the staying power has been quite remarkable.
Talking to Carlos Suarez Carrasquillo from the University of Florida, looking at the more than a week now of protests in Puerto Rico. Carlos, you mentioned those leaked communications, the corruption charges. Is there also a baseline of anger in Puerto Rico over the slow recovery from Hurricane Maria?
This has been the culmination of a series of events. The inefficient way, or really the way that the recovery was led, was problematic, and these chats could potentially lead to what has been rumored for a long time, which is that sometimes the provision of services for the recovery was withheld for political considerations, or because they were looking to make a profit out of withholding some of this aid. And these are rumors now. but there are rumors that there are more chats that could be leaked in the coming days, weeks, that might point to this issue more directly. But at this point, that's a rumor.
What are protesters looking for now? The resignation, it sounds like, of Governor Rossello for a start.
Yes, that would be step one. But also, there's a larger issue of people being fed up with a pattern of corruption. Not only that, but inefficiency in government. And also, some could argue what has been happening in the past decades, which is the percentage of Puerto Ricans who participate in elections has been decreasing by each turn. And what's interesting is that people who have been maybe not been willing to vote as they have in the past, yet are willing to engage politically through other means. And in this case, it's mass mobilization.
I've seen some arguments, some concerns from people who advocate for Puerto Rico who say all this attention on corruption there sometimes is used to legitimize more control coming from the U.S. Congress and the U.S. president rather than leaving solutions in the hands of the people of Puerto Rico. What do you make of that tension?
Yes. Some people were significantly concerned by an editorial that came out recently of one of the main newspapers in the U.S. that argued for greater deepening of the austerity measures that are supported by the fiscal board and by the U.S. Congress. Yes, that's certainly a concern. A lot of the people who have mobilized are aware that Governor Rosselló is part of the dynamic that has led the island to the situation, but also the austerity measures, and to be on the lookout that this might not give some justification to greater austerity policies. So yes, that's a significant component. People argue that addressing who is holding the office of governor is not enough, and that actually the structure of the austerity measures and the advisory board that is comprised of people that were not elected by Puerto Ricans. They were nominated by the Obama administration and the members of Congress at the time, should be either dismantled or certainly changed in some capacity. So yes, the concerns that mobilize people go well beyond Governor Rosselló, but he would be the first step of several steps to come in the eyes of many of the people who are taking it to the streets.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Carlos, the governor, Governor Rosselló, says he won't run again, but he's going to serve out his term. There is some talk of impeachment. Does that seem like a likely possible outcome?
It is possible, but the challenge is the following, that you have the House of Representatives and the Senate would need to have enough votes to get this done. And also, one thing that should be noted is that currently Puerto Rico does not have a secretary of the governor's office. It would be the second in command, if you will. So that position being vacant means that according to the Puerto Rican constitution, he would be the second person in charge, and that position is currently vacant. So that also makes this process more difficult. There's a debate of whether the governor wanted the second in the constitutional chain to be out on purpose to create a gridlock. And that's also part of the conversation.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Carlos Suarez Carrasquillo, political scientist with the Center for Latin American Studies at the University of Florida. Thanks to Carlos for joining us today. He was with us to talk about the massive street protests in Puerto Rico and the fate of Governor Ricardo Rosselló. Coming up, we'll talk to the Wisconsin chef about her cooking classes for kids that will take place in local libraries. Stay with us on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin chef tells us how she gets kids excited about cooking. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a report on a recent gathering for peace in northern Wisconsin.
Iron River is a small city of about 1,100 residents in northern Wisconsin. But around five times that many people recently traveled to the area to make it their temporary home. They're known as the Rainbow Family of Living Light. The loose-knit group has been meeting every year in a national forest since 1972. Daniel Kading made the trek to the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest for the height of their event earlier this month on the 4th of July.
About 20 minutes south of Iron River, cars with license plates from almost every state in the nation lined Kent Hook Lake Road within the Shawangunkanikolai National Forest. Some people traveled thousands of miles just to get to this point. It's about another hour by foot, at times in the rain, to get to the meadow. At midday, that's where hundreds joined hands in a vast circle to meditate and pray for peace. After a while, the crowd erupted into cheers and celebration. People danced and played music. They hugged one another, saying "I love you" to those they met. Many wore tie-dyed clothes, and some had elaborate costumes, like a rainbow-colored jester carrying a flat disco ball. A few wore nothing at all. Karen Zirk came from San Diego, California, for the 4th.
So much emotion and love that's here. We did this Om. It's like we found a way to bring peace down to earth for at least one day.
The gathering means different things to different people, but love, peace, and unity seem to be a common thread that knit them together. Jeffrey Carpenter of Baltimore, Maryland, who goes by the rainbow name Yona, said it's a welcoming community.
So if you want to be a nudist, that's cool. If you want to be a train punk, that's cool too. If you want to be like Hare Krishna, you want to be like anything, like it's all kind of wide open. It feels like for me, it just feels like a large no judgment zone.
Feather Sherman has been helping with rainbow gatherings for years. She lives on the road in her 93 Subaru. Sherman said the gathering is significant because people need to come together and save the earth from environmental harm.
We are killing ourselves as a human species and everything else going with it. So it's vital. It's important that we come together and work for world peace and harmony and learn how to get along.
The rainbow family has to learn to live together because it has no official leaders. They rely on one another for things like food, water, or medical supplies. People can donate during dinner circles at night to help fund expenses. Sherman said some members take part in the rainbow family's Spring Council and Vision Council.
Those who choose to would like to counsel about, in particular, where we're going to go next year, our vision about the future, what projects people are doing, but especially for the gathering itself, maybe some critiquing about how things could go better.
Sherman said that includes things like working with the U.S. Forest Service to restore the landscape after gatherings, but some locals were skeptical of the rainbow family. Back in Iron River, cashier Abby Nelson at O'Brien's C-Store said some people were leery of the rainbow family.
I haven't seen anything bad happen. I know there's some people who are, like the police have been getting involved, and some people are being pulled over for, like, drugs and stuff. A lot of people don't want drugs coming into Iron River either. You have a great
day. Bayfield County Sheriff Paul Susanka said they had about 30 arrests, mostly misdemeanors and a couple felony drug charges. He said cooperation between federal, state, and local law enforcement helped things go smoothly.
So our expectation isn't that people come and enjoy themselves but cause no harm to the community. And I think that's a reasonable request.
Susanka said most people went along with that. Rainbow family members said there's always a few bad apples with any group. Karen Zirk said they always end up embracing local residents.
When they end up embracing us, no matter their political beliefs, their religious tradition, you know, when you lead with love, you win everyone over.
A spokeswoman for the U.S. Forest Service wouldn't say whether the Rainbow Family won them over, but if there's one thing they have in common, she said it's a love for the land.
WPR's Daniel Kading brought us that story about the Rainbow Family gathering in Iron River. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, libraries can be great places for kids and adults to find a book or movie to enjoy, but they offer classes, too. And in Madison, some of the libraries are offering what might seem like a surprising hands-on learning opportunity, cooking classes for kids. Lily Kilfoy, also known as the Kids Chef, is a cooking instructor and freelance chef from Madison. She holds a degree in culinary arts from Madison College and has a background in early childhood education. Lily, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, some people might think, let's wait to start teaching people to cook till they're closer to being out and on their own and cooking for themselves. Why start earlier?
Oh, there's so many benefits to cooking at a young age. The sooner you get your hands on healthy foods, sooner you get exposed to healthy ingredients, the better off you'll be at making those choices later in life.
And it seems like a natural for you. You've got a background, I understand, in early childhood education and, of course, in cooking. How did you come up with the idea of taking this to the libraries to teach kids?
Well, when I went to culinary school about 10 years ago, I knew right away that I didn't want to be a restaurant chef. There was a simulated fine dining in the second year of school restaurant, and it just wasn't for me. And I, you know, I did have a background in early childhood education. So I thought to myself, how can I get out of the restaurant kitchen and work with kids? So I came up with the concept of kids cooking classes, and it kind of took off from there. Nobody else in Madison was really doing it at the time, so I decided to give it a shot.
And libraries. We don't think of libraries as a place of food.
Yeah, well, you know, it really isn't, but now it is in Madison. So hopefully it will spread to all over the country.
And talk about what it's like then. You're in the library's kitchen or whatever you've set up as a temporary kitchen spot. How do kids respond when you start teaching them?
Kids respond wonderfully. You know, they really want to get their hands in the mix. They really want to chop stuff up. They want to saute vegetables. They want to know how to prepare different dishes. They seem to really, really love it.
And I think some people, and I'll put myself in this, so when I worked with my kids on cooking, the safety issue, and we're, oh, there are knives, there's hot stuff. How do we do this in a safe way and also so we don't freak out the parents, the grown-ups?
Right, right. Well, I've had to learn by trial and error and trial and success, as you can imagine. I try to work with safe tools for kids, plastic knives, really kind of limit their interaction with the heat source that we have unless they're older kids. And I definitely tailor my recipes so that they're age appropriate for the group that I'm working with. I have preschool projects where the kids are making little food faces out of different vegetables. And then, you know, as kids age and progress, they can start to work with knives and heat and kind of more advanced cooking techniques.
Talking to Lily Kilfoy, also known as the Kids Chef, about her experiences teaching kids food literacy, nutrition, and cooking. Lily, talk about some of the benefits when it comes to long-term health that you're hoping kids get out of this.
Right. Well, we're really hoping that kids in the community get exposed to ingredients that they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to. We have kids that have never seen avocado, never seen tofu, never seen fresh fruits and vegetables, and we really want them to get their hands on these things at a young age so that they can choose to use these ingredients and choose a healthier way to eat, and by that, they'll have a healthier lifestyle all around.
What are some of the reactions that kids get to the foods that they've helped prepare and maybe they've never encountered before? Are they tough judges on these foods?
You know, I always ask them what they think of the foods. We reflect on the recipes afterwards. Often we'll vote on whether the recipe was a success by playing a game that I call Yum or Yuck. And the kids, they usually say yum. They're usually pretty responsive to eating the things that they created. I think if a kid has the opportunity to make something, they're going to be much more likely to try it, much more likely to respond to it positively, and they have pride in it.
You've worked with adults and teens and kids, and sometimes with learning stuff, you think, okay, it's going to be easier to work with the adults. I've been in some situations where it's not. Is it easier? Are kids more like sponges? They want to learn this stuff fast?
Kids are easier to work with because they're more forgiving and they're more flexible. Adults want concrete answers. They expect things to have concrete results. And kids really understand that there's an ebb and flow in life and that if you make mistakes in the kitchen, you can learn from those mistakes. And they're really, really responsive to that. So I do prefer working with kids, honestly.
Yeah, I can see myself like, oh, I'm scared. I don't want to get it wrong. I don't want to screw this up. And a kid, forget
exactly
about it. Exactly. That's great.
They have no preconceived notions of how it's supposed to turn out.
Now, you've done this also, I understand, in some libraries that don't have any kitchen facilities at all. How do you come up with cooking classes with no
yeah,
gear?
Yeah, you're right. It's really, it can be difficult. You know, for a couple of years, I just did cold recipes where we would do things like wraps and lemonades, fruit salads. And I started to get a little bit bored with that. And I realized that the kids needed to be challenged a little bit more. I started to bring in electric griddles, blenders, juicers, hot plates. I even have a transportable oven that I brought to the library before. I've blown multiple fuses. We've kind of had to figure out our maximum capacity for my appliances that I like to bring in. But, you know, I come up with the recipe, and I think that just through doing it throughout the years, you know, I just kind of know what will work and what won't work at this time. And things seem to really work for us. We've made little pizzas. We've made tortillas. We've made sushi. We've done so many different cooking projects.
Do you have advice for a parent who might be thinking, yeah, I'd love my kid to be able to cook, but I'm not that great a cook myself. I don't know where to start for me, much less them.
Come to one of my cooking classes. You can find me at Madison Public Libraries, Willie Street Co-op. And, you know, just get in the kitchen and be open to making mistakes. We learn from mistakes. We learn from practice. I tell kids, how do you get good at basketball? How do you get good at soccer? You get out there on the field and you practice and you practice. The same thing goes for cooking. You get yourself in the kitchen.
And I love what you were saying about the different things you tried with the kids. I think sometimes I think of cooking means all the burners are going and the oven's on and you're stirring over here. You have to have all the things going. It might be as simple as, hey, what's a nice wrap? You can start small and work up from there.
Absolutely. You know, with the preschool story time group that I do at Meadow Ridge Library, the food faces that I was talking about, we take hummus and we smear it on bread. And then I have, you know, different chopped up carrots and mushrooms and cherry tomatoes and peas for eyes and radishes. And so I've already chopped these things up. And really, the kids are picking out what they want to put on the face is the facial features, and they're eating these vegetables after they make the little face, and that's the first introduction to cooking. You can't start with the fire and knives. You have to start somewhere, and that's just the exposure to the vegetables.
Lily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Lily Kilfoy, also known as the Kids Chef. She's a cooking instructor and freelance chef from Madison. She holds a degree in culinary arts from Madison College and has a background in early childhood education. We talked to her about her cooking classes for young people that she holds in libraries. Coming up, our guest tells us why Major League Baseball has a home run crisis. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Wednesday morning, former special counsel Robert Mueller will testify about his investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election. He'll appear in separate sessions before the Judiciary and Intelligence Committees in the U.S. House. You can hear live coverage of Mueller's testimony. It starts at 7:30 in the morning on Wednesday here on the Ideas Network. Now, if you're a fan of home runs, 2019's been a real treat for you, especially here in Wisconsin. The Milwaukee Brewers are on pace to break the single-season record for most homers hit by a team, and outfielder Christian Yelich leads all of Major League Baseball in home runs. But some people say you can have too much of a good thing. Major League players are on pace to hit about 6,700 home runs this year. That would shatter the current record by about 600. Three players, including Yelich, have a legitimate shot at hitting 60 homers, a feat nobody has pulled off since 2001. As for the Brewers threatening the single-season team home run mark, well, three other teams are also on track to beat it. In fact, there are so many homers that our guest says a lot of people are worried they may be killing the sport. Jared Diamond is a sports reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He focuses on Major League Baseball. Jared, thanks a lot for joining us today. Jared, do we have you on the line?
Yes, you do.
Oh, there you are. Great.
Hello?
So, yep, home runs, Jared. Once upon a time, we thought they were the best thing in a game. Why are people seeing this home run glut being bad for baseball?
Like anything, everything is best in moderation. You look at the home run, the statistic of the home run, and for all of baseball history, what made it so special was largely because how rare it was. The home run was seen as the ultimate sign of strength, of power. It was awe-inspiring because of not everybody could do it. Now, all of a sudden, not only are they not rare, they're among the most frequent things you see in a baseball game, where it seems like anyone could hit a home run at any time. And it's just changed the aesthetics of baseball in such a way that it certainly turned off a certain segment of the fan base.
Give us a sense. I mentioned a couple stats setting this up, but give us a sense of how many more home runs we're seeing compared to most of baseball history. I'm going to jump in. We're losing our connection with sports writer Jared Diamond with the Wall Street Journal. I'll invite you to call in at 800-642-1234. Are you a baseball fan? Have you been or have you stopped being a baseball fan? What do you think about all the home runs in the game? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Do you get excited when the Brewers are hitting so many home runs this year? Or do you think it's all making the game a little more boring this year over time? What do you think is behind all the home runs? There are lots of them. Is it making the game less interesting for you? Also, more strikeouts, it seems like. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I think we have Jared on another connection now. Jared, hi. Do we have you on the air? One more. Jared, are you there?
I am here.
Okay, great. So you were talking. Sorry, we lost our connection on that other mode of communication. But give us a sense of how big the home run glut is now compared to baseball history.
Sure. Until 2017, the most home runs ever hit in a season, Major League Baseball, was hit in 2000, which 2000, we all know, was the heart of the steroid era where an unbelievable amount of home runs were hit. All of a sudden, here in 2019, we're looking at potentially 1,000 more home runs hit this year than there were then. And the idea that there could be 1,000 more home runs hit than the heart of the steroid era in 2000, it's really almost unfathomable for anyone that's been a baseball fan for many decades.
What the heck is going on? Why are there so many home runs this year?
Well, finally, after a few years of Major League Baseball denying what was obvious to everybody, finally, MLB is acknowledging that the number one reason why the game has changed so much is the baseballs itself. The baseballs themselves are traveling farther than they ever did before. They're more aerodynamic. They have less drag, which means they have less resistance to the air than they did in the past. And it's created really a lot of frustration among not just fans, but players. There's a segment of Major League players, a large segment, that believe that Major League Baseball has done this on purpose, that the commissioner of baseball has taken it upon himself to juice the baseballs in order to generate more offense. Major League Baseball denies that very strongly. They insist that this is a manufacturing quirk, that they don't know why this is happening. And it's created really a rift in some ways between players that just want transparency and the league.
Yeah, there's a quote from Justin Verlander talking to ESPN during the All-Star break. Justin Verlander of the Houston Astros. I think we've got the quote cleaned up a little here. He said the balls are a joke. He said they've been using juiced balls in the home run derby in the All-Star break forever. They know how to do it, he says. It's not coincidence. I find it really hard to believe, Verlander says, that Major League Baseball owns Rawlings, the makers of baseballs, and just coincidentally, the balls become juiced. So the physics of this, apparently the core of the ball is better centered now. And some people said, no, it's not on purpose. It's just better manufacturing technique. What's the state of the debate on whether this is being done on purpose, Jared?
Well, that's what Major League Baseball says. They say that they've changed nothing, that the materials are all the same, that the process is the same. And all that's changed, maybe, is that the pill, the center of the ball, is more centered than it was before because they've just gotten so good at manufacturing baseballs. They're too good at manufacturing baseballs, and that has caused this supercharged ball. Now, it is true that baseballs are stitched by hand. It is a very human process, and then it comes as a surprise to a lot of people. There is no machine that is making Major League Baseballs. It is done at a factory in Costa Rica with real people. So there is expected variation from year to year or batch to batch of baseballs. But what we're seeing right now is a version of the ball that it's like a pinball. It is exploding off the bat. And it is the biggest reason why home runs have gone up so much.
Home runs and strikeouts, apparently. Is there a change in strategy, maybe knowing about these balls, where there's no reason not to swing for the fences?
Sure. We've seen strikeouts on the rise for years, and that has just increased over the past couple of years. We've seen a record number of strikeouts. It seems like every season there's going to be a record number of strikeouts again this year. And there are a few reasons for that that have to do with strategy. Certainly, the rise of data analytics in baseball have shown what now seems so obvious, but wasn't always obvious to teams and fans. It's that home runs are so far and away the best outcome of any at-bat that you are better off as a hitter trying to hit them, even at the expense of strikeouts, of contact. It used to be that strikeouts were seen as shameful. They were embarrassing. With two strikes, you should shorten your swing just to put the ball in play. And increasingly, teams feel, using data that was not available to them in the past, that you shouldn't do that, that you're better off trying to hit a home run, even with two strikes. And if you strike out, that's okay, at least in most situations.
So is there evidence that fans don't like this, the fact that there are more and more plays, home runs, strikeouts, and I think walks too, where the ball never gets into play?
I'm not sure that it's fans don't like home runs, per se. In fact, I think a large segment of fans really do like home runs. I think they love home runs. But I think there's sort of some repercussions that have come with this version of baseball. The record number of strikeouts, the record number of home runs, the increase in walks, it's created a game where it's very slow. The games take longer than ever. And there's a lot less action than ever before. The ball is frequently not in play. You watch a baseball game today, and largely what you're watching is the pitcher and catcher playing catch with one another, and occasionally a home run, which is exciting, but not at the expense of what used to be in the game. A lot of action, balls in play, people running, sort of feats of athleticism that have been lost. And there's certainly a divide among fans. Some, I think, really love this style of play. There are others that certainly don't, but...
We're going to hear from some of those fans in just a moment. We're talking about the barrage of home runs being hit this year in Major League Baseball, on pace for a record by a large margin, and concerns that it's hurting the game. Jared Diamond is our guest. He writes about sports for the Wall Street Journal. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you still find home runs exciting, or is the thrill gone for you? Does it help that the Brewers are one of the top home run hitting teams in the league and that Christian Yelich is the league leader? Do you miss the days of singles, doubles, triples, groundouts, rundowns? Should Major League Baseball do anything to cut down on the number of home runs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Yelich a drive, hit back into center field, and that is a no-doubter, number 35 for Christian Yelich, and it's a 10-6 ball game.
Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Get up, get up, get out of here. We're talking about baseball's home run problem with Jared Diamond. He covers Major League Baseball for the Wall Street Journal, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think baseball has a home run crisis? Too many home runs? Is it getting boring? Plus strikeouts, walks, the ball not in play as much? Should baseball do something? Or are you excited? Are you glad to see the home runs? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls. Tim is with us in Chicago. Tim, hi.
Yes, I think there are too many home runs. You know, you think about when you were younger and you played, it's a small ball game, singles, doubles, stealing. And that just isn't in Major League Baseball today. You know, as the person from the Journal said, you see very little action and less strategy in terms of hitting and fielding. How many double plays do you see anymore? It's very rare from a defense perspective. So, yeah, I am a little worried. And the games are just too long.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Jared, the concern about the length of games too, but that feeling that there isn't that kind of on-the-field strategy anymore of hitting and fielding, for that matter.
Yeah, the caller brought up a really interesting point, which is the game has gotten smarter. There's no question about it that baseball is smarter now than ever before. Just because it's smarter doesn't mean that it's more entertaining. And ultimately, this is an entertainment product. This is for fans. If it's not entertaining and people don't watch, it doesn't really matter if it's being played at an ideal level. And that's what all sports are dealing with, this idea of how do we change our game to sort of balance these two issues? Let's make the game smarter without losing what makes it fun. The NFL and the NBA have been very aggressive in making rule changes. To that effect, rule changes exclusively for entertainment. Baseball has been a lot more reluctant to do so. There's a lot more history in baseball. There's a lot more sort of clinging to tradition and not wanting to reach in and do things if you're the commissioner. But I think it's reaching the point where they're certainly considering having to make changes exclusively to ensure that the product remains entertaining.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Tony now in Waukesha. Tony, hi.
Hi. My question was about, like, consumption patterns in baseball. You know, the older generation likes to sit around and watch the game, listen on the radio. Middle age wants to watch it on SportsCenter. But my son consumes it on a Major League Baseball app. And so the home runs and quick strikeouts, they package up real well. He can watch the whole league in 20 minutes on his iPad. So I'm just wondering, as we shift more to digital content distribution, if that's not really an advantage for the league in terms of the change in the game.
Tony, thanks for the call. Interesting point. Home runs are easy to put online and watch in just a few moments, Jared.
They are, and that's something that baseball likes. Baseball likes people watching the game on their app, on social media. They like sort of that highlight style of the game. That's what the NBA has been so good at in recent years, packaging sort of great plays, dunks, superstar players as something you have to sort of look the next morning on social media to see. So baseball likes that element of it. And that's sort of the problem with this whole sort of question. It's that some of this is good for baseball and some of it is bad. And how do you sort of keep the good without getting rid of the bad? And how do you sort of not alienate a lot of people? I don't think you can make everybody happy. It's impossible to make everybody happy. The question is, how do you make the least possible people unhappy to keep them engaged and keep them watching? And most importantly for baseball, spending money. And that's this is an $11 billion business. They intend for it to keep growing, not start to shrink.
Tony, thanks for the call. As a counterpoint, Jared, when I was a kid watching This Week in Baseball, they'd show home runs. Yeah, fine, whatever. The exciting fielding highlights, the rundowns, the cool plays, those are, I always thought those were the good baseball highlights that I would have wanted to watch online.
Yeah, me too. And I wonder how sometimes what today's youth or kids today, what they like in baseball. There's very clear that baseball's audience is aging. We know that. In fact, the average age of a baseball watcher on TV is in his mid-50s. That's sad for baseball. That is not what baseball wants. You want something closer to the NBA audience, which is young, which is sort of the people that will soon have disposable income that they could spend on tickets. And I think baseball does fear sort of its audience aging out. So it's trying to figure it out. TV ratings for everything are going down. So I don't know if TV ratings are as big of a concern as they used to be, but they're still not nothing because these TV deals, these giant TV deals with Fox, with ESPN, that's what pays the bill. That's where most of baseball's money comes from these days. It's not tickets. It's not merchandise. It's these giant multi-billion dollar deals.
Just to clarify, when I was watching This League in Baseball as a child, there was no online to watch these highlights on. We're talking to Jared Diamond from the Wall Street Journal about a home run crisis, people say, in baseball. Too many home runs, more boring game, some people say. Back to your calls. Lisa is with us in Green Bay. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling to say that when it's my team playing, there can't be too many home runs. If the team that they're playing against gets home runs, that's too many home runs.
Lisa, thanks a lot for the call. So, Lisa, yeah, a fan-based perspective there. Jared, okay for my team, not for others. Are there still people in it who are just, you know, they get excited when their team hits a home run and that keeps them in the game?
Oh, there's no question about it. Home runs do excite people. Let's not forget, home runs are still incredibly exciting. They are just jolts of action in a game that at times has very little action. So when they do happen, there is still this rise. They certainly get fans excited. There's also a segment of baseball fans, a large segment,
that really doesn't care about the aesthetics of the product as long as their team wins. I'm sure there's a lot of Brewers fans out there that will say it doesn't matter, just like the caller said. It doesn't matter how many home runs are hit in the game as long as the Brewers win. And there's always going to be sort of those hardcore fans that feel that way. But baseball needs more than that. Baseball needs people to keep watching even when their team is out. Baseball needs people to tune into the World Series whether or not their team is in it, because only two teams could be in the World Series every year. And you think about the Super Bowl, for instance, and the World Series will never be the Super Bowl, but everybody watches the Super Bowl. It doesn't really matter who is playing in it. The World Series has had a problem with that, where it seems like it's very local, it's very regional, and once your team is out, people kind of tune out.
Thanks for the call, Lisa. We'll go now to David in Lake Forest, Illinois. David, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you. I have a quick question. I mean, back in the day, Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, when they were hitting home runs all the time, I feel like baseball was at the height of its popularity, and now all of a sudden you're saying there's too many home runs. I guess I'll wait for your answer there. And the second point is, I think the popularity is declining because there aren't, like, Pedro Martinez, marquee pitchers dueling it out. That's my point of view, not the home runs. Thank you.
David, thanks for the call. So, yeah, it was exciting when Sosa and McGwire were in this home run duel and we weren't worried about performance-enhancing substances quite yet.
Yeah, there are two interesting points there. I actually want to address the second point first about the pitchers, the lack of great starting pitchers. I agree with that. I think that's a big problem in baseball. And that sort of goes back to my point about just because the game is played better doesn't mean it's played smarter. Because of analytics now, teams do not use starting pitchers for the entire game. In fact, they tend to take their starting pitchers out two times through the order. There's all this data that says a pitcher facing a lineup a third time is bad. They struggle. So teams take them out. Or they go for full bullpen games, which is very trendy now. It works. There's no doubt that works. It doesn't mean that it's fun to watch. There's something exciting about seeing a pitcher put a team on his back and go eight or nine innings. And you don't see that anymore. As for the first point about McGwire and Sosa, first of all, there are 1,000, like I said, 1,000 more home runs than there were back then. That's a big difference to me. 1,000 is not an insignificant number. The other issue is one of distribution. When McGwire and Sosa were hitting all those home runs, they were hitting astronomical amounts of home runs. They were hitting 70 in the case of McGwire. What we're seeing now is different. We're not seeing a whole bunch of players hitting 50 or even 60. What we're seeing is an enormous amount of players hitting 20. That's not necessarily the same as a couple of guys hitting 50, 55, 60. You're just seeing guys that in the past would hit 6 or 7 home runs hitting 20. I think that distribution of where the homers are coming from makes a difference.
Do you think, Jared, as we start to wrap up, that Major League Baseball as an institution actually sees this as a problem?
Rob Manfred, the commissioner of baseball, has said many times that the owners believed, the owners who are his bosses essentially, would like there to be fewer home runs in baseball. They think that it's aesthetically better when the game is not played quite in this way. But they acknowledge that there is a divide among fans. Their internal research says that some fans, some segment of the fans, love this style of baseball and others do not. And I think part of it is generational. I think longtime fans who grew up watching baseball in the 60s or the 70s, the baseball they remember is essentially gone. And I think baseball is a game of nostalgia. It's a game that sort of transcends time. It moves through the decades. And when suddenly the game you remember falling in love with when you're 11 years old is gone, I think it's hard to sort of get on board with the game now. Now, for kids that were born in the heart of the steroid era, grew up watching baseball in the 90s and 2000s, I think they might have a different perspective on things.
Jared, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Jared Diamond. He writes about Major League Baseball for the Wall Street Journal. We talked to him about why many people say the sport has a home run crisis. This year, players are on pace to hit about 6,700 homers. That would be 600 more than the previous record set in 2017. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the head of Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction joins the show for a look at education spending and the upcoming school year. After years of economic recovery, we'll take a look at the big trends in Wisconsin when it comes to wages, jobs, and income. And have you learned something new lately, or is there something you want to learn? We'll ask for your calls on lifelong learning. That's tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 7:30, CBD oil is showing up at stores all over Wisconsin. Kate Archer-Kent talks to an investigative reporter about how the marijuana derivative is being sold and used and shares stories of the people who are part of the growing trend. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on the morning show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about the rise of the so-called alt-right, their goals, and the messages they use to advance them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.